Well, welcome. Thank you for coming. I'm always surprised when anybody comes back the following week. And if you're here for the first time, special welcome to you. It's great to have you here. I will say a word or two of recap. So if you know you're coming in for the third of four, don't worry. I will recap in a minute. Before I do that, I want to begin with the question that we're going to be focusing on today, which is the question, why won't God answer me? Why won't God answer my question or my questions? And I want to explain at the very beginning that by that question, I don't mean it as what I sometimes call an armchair question. That is, I don't mean that as the kind of question that we all sometimes ask when we're comfortably relaxing with a cup of coffee in an armchair, and we're not very troubled, but we say in the way that a religious or philosophical dilettante might say, I'd be really quite intrigued and interested to know the answer to this question. It's not that kind of question that I'm wanting us to think about today. I'm wanting us to think about what I sometimes call the wheelchair question. That is the question that is asked by the sufferer or by the person who's sitting with the sufferer. And it's the question, why, oh why, in God's name am I suffering like this, or is he or she suffering like this? It's the strong, agonized, existential question, why, that I'm wanting us to focus on. Now, I realize that probably for the majority of us that may not be quite where we are at the moment. That'd be great if we're not. But at some point it will be. Maybe in the past it has been, and maybe for some it is. But that's the question that we're going to focus on. I'm going to begin by reading you a haunting poem. It's a poem by Wilfred Owen, who is one of the First World War Western Front poets. And it's simply called Futility. Some of you may know it. It's a poem that is written as Owen looks at the still warm corpse of a young soldier who's been pointlessly killed on the Western Front in the First World War. Let me read it to you, and then I'll say a word or two about it. Move him into the sun. Gently its touch awoke him once at home, whispering of fields half sown. Always it woke him, even in France, until this morning and this snow. If anything might rouse him now, the kind old sun will know. Think how it wakes the seeds, woke once the clays of a cold star. Our limbs, so dear achieved, our sides full-nerved, still warm, too hard to stir. Was it for this the clay grew tall? Oh, what made fatuous sunbeams toil to break earth's sleep at all? I wonder if you noticed how in that poem Wilfred Owen goes, I think, very movingly from the little question why to the big question why. And how he begins with the question, why did this man, this young man, this individual life have to be lost so futilely, so pointlessly? But then he goes on, and the logic of it is this: if we live in the kind of world where this kind of futile, pointless thing happens, why was the world made at all? Why did fatuous sunbeams toil to break earth's sleep at all? The question that Wilfred Owen asks in that poem is the question we're focusing on today, and it is Job's question. 2 weeks ago, if you were here, you may remember that we were introduced to this man, Job. I put the very first verse of his book on the handout on the front page, and we were introduced to him as a man who was, as the writer describes him, blameless and upright, one who feared God, that is, he bowed before God in loving reverence before the living God, and because he feared God, he turned away from evil. And it was a lovely start to the book, this fine, upright man who loved and feared God and turned from evil. And if you were here 2 weeks ago, you'll remember how in the first two chapters of Job's book, we see this upright, blameless man almost destroyed by suffering. And we see his possessions destroyed. We see his children killed. And we see his health broken. And at the end of the first week, in chapter 2 of his book, we left him sitting on a rubbish heap, lonely, scraping himself, and in utter misery and desolation. And last week I mentioned that in chapter 3 of his book, which we haven't had time to consider, he gives one of the darkest, blackest laments in the history of the human race. And in that lament, he twice asks the question, why? Why is light given, he says, to someone whose life is such utter and total misery? What's the point? Twice he asks that. Why does God do this? What's the point of the whole thing? Now, I'm going to skip over the second week, although I've put the headings on the handout. But if you've got the structure of the book, you'll see that from chapter 4 right through to chapter 27, Job's three friends who join him near the beginning of the book and Job have a terrific set to. And for 24 chapters, they go at it hammer and tongs, voices raised, tempers getting hot, and they shout at each other, and Job laments, and the friends shout at Job, and it just goes on and on and on. But in terms of resolution of anything, they really get nowhere for 24 chapters. So by the time we reach the end of chapter 27, if we're reading through the book from the beginning, we are beginning to wonder whether the book is going to get anywhere, or it's just going to end up completely pointless. And then in chapter 28, which is the chapter that we're going to be considering today, we suddenly have a complete change of tone, and there's a pause, and there's a quiet, reflective poem, and we're going to look at it together. It's almost like the chorus in a Greek tragedy. It doesn't seem to be spoken particularly by Job to his comforters, nor by his comforters to Job. It seems to be addressed by the poet to us, the reader and the listener. Here is a pause for thought. And on the face of it, this pause for thought is completely irrelevant to the book so far. So let's launch in, and I'm hoping that I can persuade you that it's far from irrelevant as it develops. I've divided it, I think, sensibly into three parts. And it begins, the first 11 verses, by showing us or drawing us into what I've called a costly search for a priceless treasure. And without any explanation, the poet kicks off, "Surely there is a mine for silver and a place for gold that they refine. Iron is taken out of the earth and copper is smelted from the ore." So right at the beginning, the poet says, "Come with me on a search for something valuable, gold, silver, iron, copper, and a search that's going to be costly." And so he goes on, verse 3, "Man puts an end to darkness, searches out to the farthest limit the ore in gloom and deep, deep darkness. He opens shafts in a valley, away from where anyone lives. They are forgotten, they, that is the miners, are forgotten by travellers. They hang in the air, far away from mankind. They swing to and fro." Incidentally, it's one of the oldest descriptions in human literature of mining. And we have this picture of these brave men hanging dangerously from ropes, perhaps in a vertical shaft. And the poet says, here is a search for something they consider valuable, but it's a search that is lonely. You see verse 4, forgotten by travellers. It's dangerous and it's difficult. And immediately, if we're reading through the book of Job, we begin to think of Job. Here is Job, who again and again says why. He's searching for meaning and understanding. Because Job understands, as it's been well said, that it's not suffering that destroys a person, but suffering without a purpose. And Job is searching to understand. And the poet sets before us this picture of human mining and technology as a picture of that search in some ways. So he goes on, verse 5, "As for the earth, out of it comes bread," that's the easy bit, agriculture, on the top, "but underneath, it is turned up as by fire," or as we might say, by dynamite. "Its stones are the place of sapphires, and it has dust of gold." And then he goes on, verse 7, "That path the place where the miners go. No bird of prey knows, the falcon's eye hasn't seen it, the proud beasts haven't trodden it, the lion hasn't passed over it. Here is something very remote. The lion, for all his greatness, doesn't bother with it, and the falcon, or the bird of prey with his eagle eye, isn't really interested in it and can't see it anyway. Here is a search that characterizes human beings, this search for something valuable and precious. Verse 9, man puts his hand to the flinty rock, he overturns mountains by the roots, he cuts out channels in the rocks, and his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up the streams so they don't trickle, and the thing that's hidden he brings out to light. Now, what is the point of drawing us into this search? Well, the poet tells us right away at the beginning of the second section, verse 12, but where shall wisdom be found? Now, before we look at the second section, I want to say a word or two about wisdom and what the Bible means by wisdom. We think of wisdom in a fairly trivial sense very often, don't we? We think of wisdom as just the opposite of common sense foolishness, you know, the average stupidity that hangs something upside down on the wall or anything like that. But the Bible concept in the Old Testament of wisdom, as it were, with a capital W, is a very, very big idea, and I want to say a little bit about it. If you look at the top of that page of the handout, I've put there a verse from elsewhere in the Old Testament, from the book of Proverbs, where we read, "The Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding he established the heavens." The same thing said twice in Hebrew parallelism, wisdom, understanding, synonyms. And the idea is this, that the world we live in and the universe we live in has about it an order and a structure. And wisdom with a capital W, as it is, as it were, the architecture or the structure or shape, the underlying structure or shape of the universe. That's what the Old Testament understands by wisdom. Sometimes we talk, I imagine that if you're a computer scientist or something like that, we talk about the architecture of a piece of software or hardware. And by the architecture of it, we mean, if I can grasp how the whole thing is put together, then I will understand why it behaves the way it behaves. So if I can grasp the architecture, I've grasped the structure, and therefore how it behaves and why it behaves as it does. I've grasped the answer to the question why, in some senses. Now, this is the question of Job. He's longing to understand the architecture of the universe. Now, those of us here who are scientists or in any form of technology will understand that obviously we who are involved in those kinds of enterprises, we take it for granted that this universe in its material nature has a structure and order. There's no point doing science unless you think there is some kind of order or structure in the material universe, which is incidentally why so many of the roots of the modern scientific enterprise lie in Christian soil. But that's a digression. But it's true. But if we take it for granted, many of us, I expect, that the material universe has some kind of structure, what we sometimes call physical laws, to which it conforms, at least in general, the Bible wants to say to us that the structure of the universe is not confined to the material world, but it extends also to the moral world of the universe. The structure of the universe is not only material, but also moral. And there is a structure to right and wrong and crime and punishment and virtue and reward and so on. And that it would be absurd to suppose that this universe had a structure in its physical or material aspect, without also understanding that it has a wider structure. Now, wisdom is the Old Testament shorthand word for that architecture of the universe, material as well as moral. I have no idea where I've got to in my notes, so we'll see. Right, let's go on to the second section with that introduction. Verse 12, where shall wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Now, in this second section, the poet does something which is deeply paradoxical. There have been two motifs introduced in the first section about mining. One is that a miner is seeking to find something of value. And the second is that in seeking something of value, his search is difficult and dangerous. So the value and the difficulty are the two motifs that have been introduced. Now, in the second section, what the poet does is to sandwich these two in a more extreme form. So he begins with the inaccessibility of wisdom. So verse 12, where shall wisdom be found, and so on. Verse 13, man doesn't know its worth, that is to say, we can't count its value. And it's not found in the land of the living, the deep. That is, in Bible poetic imagery, the depths of the sea, that's where the entrances to the place of the dead are found in Old Testament poetry. The deep says, it's not here. The sea says, it's not with me. So the poet begins by saying, here's something which is very deeply and inaccessible. And then in verses 16 to 19, he goes from the inaccessibility to the value. And in verses 15 to 19, the poet heaps up in poetic imagery all the riches of the ancient Near East. Just feel it. It can't be bought for gold. Silver can't be weighed as its price. You know, pile it up as high as you like. You won't get enough to buy wisdom with a capital W. It can't be valued in the gold of Ophir. That's the best gold. Precious onyx, sapphire, gold, glass, verse 17, jewels, fine gold. No mention shall be made, you know, no point talking about coral or crystal, they're just not worth nearly enough. Price of wisdom above pearls, the topaz of Ethiopia can't be valued in gold. So the poet has said to us, here's something very inaccessible, but also incredibly valuable. And Job would agree, wouldn't he? He'd say, if only I knew the answer to the question why, if only I could understand the architecture of the universe, well then life might be worth living. But then the poet dumps us back on Job's rubbish heap, verse 20. From where then does wisdom come? Where's the place of understanding? It's hidden from the eyes of all living, concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon, that is destruction, the angel of the bottomless pit, and death personified here. Say, we've heard a rumor of it with our ears. So the poet says, you know, you go to the furthest extremity of the universe, go down to the depths of the sea where the entrances are to the place of the dead, and ask destruction and death. And they'll shrug their shoulders and they'll say, well, yeah, I've heard a rumor that this exists, but I don't know where it is. You see what the poet's doing in the imagery? He's saying, this question why is a very difficult question. It's a very important question, but it's also a very difficult question. Now, if we stopped at the end of verse 22, if the poem stopped there, then it would indeed be a theatre of the absurd. The poet would simply have said to us, here's something we desperately need to know, and we can't know it, so there, Yabu sucks. That'd be it if it stopped at the end of verse 22, and you'd all go away thinking, why did the Christian Union bother to put on this lunchtime talk? What a waste of their time. So let's look at how the poem concludes. Verse 23, God understands the way to it, that is to wisdom, and he knows its place, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. So the poet says, the God who's made this world knows the architecture of the universe because he sees everything and we don't. That's what he said at that stage. Now, in order to illustrate verse 24, the ends of the earth, the extremities of the cosmos, he takes what I think we in Britain will think is a delightful little illustration. And he says to us, just think of something which is so wild and so out of control, of human control, and that can't really be analyzed properly with human technology, let alone controlled. The weather. I'm not sure what the Middle Eastern audience would have made of that, but certainly we can understand that. And he takes the weather and he says, it's rather nice, it's almost light-hearted really, verses 25 and 26, bit of light relief. He says, when God gave the wind its weight, that is when he said to the wind, now today I want you to blow force 1 from the north, you know, tomorrow force 3 from the southwest. That's the imagery here. That's what it's conveying. And apportioned the waters, that is the flood waters and the river waters and the seas, by measure and said, thus far, but no further. When he did that, he made a decree for the rain. He said how much, when, where to fall, and a way for the lightning of the thunder. Then God saw wisdom, declared it, established it, and searched it out. And the imagery is this. The poet is saying, we do not understand, even though by human technology, and we, of course, could expand the stuff on mining greatly, couldn't we, these thousands of years later? But human technology can do wonderful things. But human technology will never find and draw out and copy and shape the architecture of the universe, the moral architecture of the universe, as well as the material architecture of the universe, the theory of everything, as Professor Hawking called it. We're never going to be able to do that, but God can. Now, if we ended at the end of verse 27, we would still be perplexed. Actually, the poem does end at verse 27, because verse 28 is prose in the original. It doesn't have the meter of the poetry. It's like a prose postscript. If we ended at the end of verse 27, we'd have got this far. We'd have said, wisdom is very important, very valuable, very precious. It'd be very wonderful to know. It's very inaccessible to human beings, but there is a living God who does know. Okay, that's as far as we would have got at the end of verse 27. Now, verse 28 is one of the most important verses in the 42 chapters of the book of Job. So let's just look at that, and then I'm going to draw to a close, and we'll have a chance for questions. Verse 28 is the first time that in the book of Job, God speaks to human beings. First time God speaks at all since the very beginning, when it's in the heavenly courtroom. Verse 28, he, that is God, said to man, so here is something that God says to humankind, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding. Now, if we've been reading the book carefully, when God says this in verse 28, the fear of the Lord and to turn away from evil, we immediately think back to the very first verse of the book. And you've got it on your handout at the beginning. How is Job described in the very first verse of the book as a man who's blameless and upright, who fears God and turns away from evil? And now God says he was on the right track all along. See, his friends have been telling him for 24 chapters he's on the wrong track. But now at this point in the drama, God says to fear God and turn away from evil, that's wisdom and understanding for human beings. If you like, wisdom with a small w. Not wisdom with a big W, being able to grasp the moral structure of the universe. But that's what it is to do what a human being ought to do. That's the opposite of foolishness. Now, what the poet has done is very profound, because what he said to us is this, and I'm going to close in a minute with this point and one other point. What he said is this: when we say, why won't God answer my question, our focus is on the question, and we're saying, I want to know the answer to my question. And the poet is saying, don't look for the architecture of the universe. Focus on living in this world in relationship with the architect of the universe. So the message of this poem is this. Human technology, human thinking can achieve wonderful, wonderful things, but it will never grasp the architecture of the universe, as it were, in capital letters. But what human beings ought to do is to recognize that we are mortal and God is not, and to walk through this world in loving, reverent fear, bowing down before the architect and turning away from evil. That's what wisdom is for human beings. Now, it's a very profound conclusion, because it's turning from focusing on the answer to my question that I want, which, if God were to give it to me, I would become a puffed-up know-all. And it's turning me from that to saying, now focus on the architect. Walk through this world in loving, reverent fear and obedience to him, and turning from evil. That's what human beings ought to do. Now, I've put at the bottom of the third page of the handout one verse. I could have picked others from the New Testament. When the early Christians thought about Jesus of Nazareth, and when they thought about his matchless, innocent, blameless life, and when they thought about his undeserved suffering and death, and then when they thought about his glorious vindication, his bodily resurrection that they'd witnessed, they could not but think of wisdom. And so here one of the New Testament writers, the Apostle Paul, says that in Christ all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden. That the Lord Jesus Christ, as Christians believe, is wisdom, with a capital W. In him we see the architecture of the universe revealed to the extent that human beings can ever understand it. Now, that's obviously, there's a great deal more that could be said about that. And I don't have time to say this now. I want to make sure there is some time for questions. But that's the Christian understanding of the book of Job. When they looked at the life of the Lord Jesus of Nazareth, they could not but think of Job and wisdom. So I want to end with a challenge and an invitation. I want to say to all of us here, and I don't know you, but I want to say to all of us, the message of this poem is that human beings ought to walk through this world in the fear of God. That is, bowing down in loving, reverent fear for the God who's made this world. That's what we ought to do, and to turn away from evil. We will not know the answers to all our questions, but it is possible to walk through this world in fellowship with the God who made it, the architect, even if we don't see all the architecture at this stage. That's the challenge. The invitation is a very simple, practical one, and that is that the book of Job is slightly not the obvious starting point for investigating Christian faith. I'm conscious these four lunchtimes are in a way slightly odd for the Christian Union to put on. It's a sort of experiment. They may never repeat it, but there we are. But the Promise Explored groups, which I gather have really very good numbers of people going to them, are excellent opportunities. If you are in the least bit interested, you think there might be something in this business of Christian faith. Maybe you haven't thought so before, but you're beginning to think there might be something in it. They are very informal. I'm assured they meet in the ubiquitous Starbucks. They have coffee and pizza. And I'm assured that none of the things that embarrass people, that people hate about religious meetings, happen in them. So nobody prays. Is that right, Christian Union? Nobody prays? Nobody prays, thank you. Well, they may pray silently. You can't stop them doing that. But they won't pray out loud. And nobody will make you participate. If you go once, you won't be made to go again. You know, it's very relaxed, and I do commend them to you. It's a great opportunity to go and to explore these things further. How am I doing for time? Not too bad. There is time for a few questions. We finish promptly at 10 to, but there are a few minutes for questions. So if you've got any questions, anything you'd like clarified, anything you'd like to object to, now's your chance. Free for all. I've spoken very fast and said much too much. Yes. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, Christians believe that in Scripture, in the Bible, we've got revealed from God, written by human writers, but revealed from God, all that we need to know to live godly lives. So if we read and study and meditate on it, our character will be fashioned and shaped such that increasingly we'll make wise and godly decisions. But a lot of those decisions are free decisions. Sometimes we get terribly worried and we think there must be a right decision and a wrong decision. A lot of the cases, there's a slightly wiser and a slightly less wise decision. So we can relax. Other questions? Yeah. You're just... if you go to Sotheby's or Christie's, you'll end up buying something. Yes.
Does
I don't know. And the Apostle Paul speaks about seeing in a mirror darkly, sort of imperfectly, and then face to face. But I suspect that the thrust of the book of Job is that what will occupy us in the resurrection is joy and delight in the immediate presence of the God who made the world and of Jesus Christ. And that maybe we shall have our questions answered. Maybe we shan't be so worried. We'll understand that it doesn't matter so much anymore. I really don't know. But I'm sure we won't be troubled with them. We won't be screaming Job's agonized why then. Was there another question over there? No. That's back. Yeah. That's a big question, lobbed from the back. Well, my understanding as a Christian is that it means to live as a disciple of Christ, which doesn't mean knowing all the answers. It means reading with others the Bible, thinking about what we believe God has told us about his character and how we ought to live in love for God and love for our fellow human beings. And that's going to affect everything. It's going to affect our choices of job, our aspirations for career. It's going to affect how we get money, how we spend money. It's going to affect how we relate to other people. It's going to affect family things, relationships, all that kind of thing are going to be affected by it. Is that a vague hand-waving politician's answer? Yes, it is, but there we are. That's all you're getting now. Any final questions before we finish? Yes.
Verse 28, when God says to man, what's that referring to? I mean, is it something that God has said in both the promise and creation, or is there a specific instance where he said it?
Well, no, just here, really. I mean, you know, the writer of Job is saying this is what God says to human beings. Yes. I mean, Hebrew tenses are difficult. There are only two tenses in Hebrew, and what they mean in English depends on the context. But the clear implication is that this is a general statement, that this is how human beings ought to live in general.